Welcome to the USCA official podcast and a bonus episode for you. So this episode was actually originally released in early February on the Echo Ratings Eventing podcast, and it is an in-depth interview with Boyd Martin and myself. I hope you enjoy it. It is a brilliant insight into his life growing up in Australia, the move to the US, and his hopes and plans for the future as well. So here it is, When Nicole Met Boyd, originally published on the Echo Ratings Eventing podcast. You're listening to the Echo Ratings Eventing podcast, the show with a lighthearted look at the eventing world, all of the big event previews, reviews, and special guests, and of course, backed up with all of the key Echo Ratings stats. Welcome to the Echo Ratings Eventing podcast. Welcome to the Echo Ratings Eventing podcast. And listeners, we have got a really, really exciting show lined up for you. This is one that has been on our radar for a little while. He is the reigning Pan American Games gold medalist. He has been a stalwart of the US team for the last 10 years or so. Welcome to the show, Boyd Martin.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me on.
Let's go back to the beginning, because you've had such an extraordinary career, and I mean, there's so much more still to come. But talk me through your childhood, because your parents actually met at the Winter Olympics. Is that right?
Yeah, my mum's American, was born in America. She's from the Midwest over here in Illinois, and she was a speed skater for America. And my dad was from Australia, and he was a cross-country skier. So I think he skied in the 30 or 50 kilometre Nordic ski race at the Grenoble Olympics in 68. My mum was, I think, 3,000 metres speed skater. So they met there, and then she followed him home to Australia. So that's sort of how my family line got started on the other side of the world.
Amazing. So how did the love of horses and the love of eventing come into it?
Well, I'd say growing up, you know, sport was a very, very big part of our family, and sport's actually a really big part of everyone in Australia, even more so than what I've seen here in America. And, you know, as kids growing up, we were encouraged to take on all sports, and we sort of lived on the outskirts of Sydney, and so we did everything. We were on the beach, surf, life saving, we were running, we were soccer, cricket, football, rugby, and we had 3 acres. And we decided to join the pony club and had a couple of horses in the background and in the backyard, sorry. And every Sunday I used to jump on little pony and ride an hour or so up to pony club and got into equestrian sports like that. So, you know, for me, it was a great sort of upbringing, because I wasn't really good at school, or I couldn't really sit still or concentrate. And sort of when I decided to pursue a sport for a career, my parents were right behind it, where most parents would sort of freak out at their kid deciding to chase a career in training animals.
And were you ever tempted by another sport? Obviously, a really sporty upbringing. Was there ever a competitor for eventing?
I got to say, growing up, I was a very, very good runner.
Okay.
I ran the Australian Schoolboys 1500 metre when I was about 17 or 18, which was a big deal. So, but, you know, as far as a career goes, I think, you know, if I was a runner or a football player or any other athletic sport, I'd be all washed up now. I'd be finished. And, you know, by the time you're 40 or so, you're pretty much used up in other athletic sports. And with the great thing with horses is, you know, if you can look after your body, you're just you know, you can keep going and going and going. So I feel like I'm only sort of halfway through my career. And I suppose the great thing with horses is it's obviously what drew me to it was the sport and the competitions. But you can, you know, really make a great career out of it, especially here in America. It's, you know, if you're a real worker and you're a hustler, you can make a really good, you know, life for yourself and a good business as well. So it sort of was a great decision to go for the horses.
It certainly paid dividends. And when you were growing up, I know you went through Pony Club, and then there was obviously the Young Rider system in Australia. Talk to me a little bit about going to be based with Heath Ryan, because that was a big part of your sort of, I guess, the early days of your career, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a big turning point in my life, to be quite frank. Like, let's see, through the end of high school, I was a wild man. You know, I was staying out all night and living pretty fast and still loving my sport and working hard, but it was potentially a disaster. And at the age of 17, my mum and dad sent me up to the New South Wales Equestrian Centre, and I did the working student program there at Heath Rhines and Rosie Rhines. And I got to say, that was a great turning point in my life, just to have a mentor and a trainer and a legend like Heath, you know, that really could embrace these young riders, these kids, and you know, taught you how to work really hard, how to train horses, how to break horses in. You know, he's a Grand Prix dressage, 3-day eventing, and he was just he is such a wonderful guy that's high energy, and I was quite drawn to him. So to me, that was you know, looking back on it, I often wondered where I'd end up if I didn't end up being a working student at Heath's farm up there in Lochinvar. And I met great friends there, who was like guys like Jock Padgett and Kevin McNabb and Chris Burton. Sort of, we're all, there's, you know, we're all similar ages, all ended up there, up in that area, and it was just great. You know, it was hard work and horses, and yeah, it's where the fire really got lit, I think.
I'm not surprised. I mean, some of the names that you mentioned there, it was a real, I'm going to say, a breeding ground for future superstar event riders. What about moving over to the US? Because you went over in 2007. Obviously, you'd got dual citizenship anyway. Am I right in thinking that you were already, you moved over with Silver, your now wife at that point?
Well, let's see. I wanted to, you know, I did every 3-star and 4-star in Australia and New Zealand. And then I decided there was more out there. So I put a young horse called Yin Yang Yo on a cargo plane, and I come to America with him on the cargo plane and did Kentucky 3-day event. And I based here with Philip Dutton just in the weeks leading up to it, and loved it here. And then sort of went back to Australia, got married to Silver, at the same time decided that America was the place to be, and sort of spent 6 months sort of selling horses, selling all the refrigerator, got rid of our apartment, and got married, and then moved back to America permanently. And to be honest, America, I had an American passport because of my mum, so most of the Australian guys, they went to England, and I decided to give America a crack, just with the fact that I had an American passport, and it'd be a little bit easier to sort of start working, get going here. And it was a great decision. It was coming to America is a fantastic country, especially for eventing. And I really, really think that, again, that was a major turning point in my life.
And you, when you went over to America, you went back to Phillips and worked there alongside him for a couple of years before setting up on your own. What was that like? So he's been a bit of a mentor to you throughout your life in that respect. He's done the trip from Australia over to America and set up a very, very good life for himself there. I imagine that played a big part in sort of shaping your future career in the States.
Yeah, it was interesting. You know, I'd been sort of 8 years at Heath Ryan's farm, and Heath was yelling and screaming and shouting and you know, pushing himself, and, you know, really eccentric character, great guy. And then moving to Phillips, and I worked for Philip for, I think, 2 or 3 years. And he's the opposite. He was dead quiet, very organized, and wouldn't say much all day, but and equally as fantastic horseman and trainer, and again, turning into a great mentor for me. And I learned a lot from him. I think I rode for him for about 3 years as just working for him and learning everything. I mean, he's a fantastic top competitor. I mean, great businessman, really showed me the art of picking horses and getting owners, and again, hard worker, driven, and you know, ultimately turned into one of my best friends. And yeah, again, very, very lucky, a bit like landing at Heath's, just that the person that I ended up sort of working underneath ended up just being a top class, top caliber person that really showed me the way to go.
And has been such an impact as well, and was actually alongside you when you made your first senior championship appearance for the US team in 2010 in Kentucky. How was that? Because you'd been long listed for Australia for, I think, 3 Olympic Games by this point. How was that sort of first championship on what was now home soil?
It was great. I mean, I'd worked so hard in all my years and sort of dreamed in Australia of being representing Australia, and you know, and I was just, to be honest, I was a bit too green. I was a little bit inexperienced. I had a couple of good horses, but again, you know, they were injured at the wrong time, or I didn't perform at the right moment. And finally, I feel like I was a little bit more mature over here in America, and a bit more seasoned, and changed my nationality to become American. And again, I mean, I was just almost had my hand held, you know, through the whole process of the, you know, going well at Kentucky, then getting selected, then training for the WEG at Kentucky, and again, having that mentor on the team, Philip, to sort of guide me and show me the ropes. It was a surreal experience, and it was great going to Kentucky in 2010 and seeing all a couple of the guys that I grew up with in Australia. Birdo was riding for Australia. Jock Padgett somehow was riding from New Zealand, and I was riding for America. It was crazy to think, you know, a couple of years ago, we're all drinking a beer down at Lochinvar Hotel together. It was a weird experience.
I bet Heath Ryan was a very proud man after those Kentucky games. Neville Bardot was the horse that you rode. You finished inside the top 10 individually. The team just missed out on a team medal and finished in fourth place. But he actually was a horse then that played a huge part of your journey in 2011. And I think actually, at some point, listeners, we will have to do a horse heroes on him, because his career has just been extraordinary. But 2011 was a really, really tough year for you. And it all, I suppose, it was well documented at the time, and listeners, many of you might be aware of it, but actually a fire at your barn, I suppose, changed everything. Talk us through that, because it is your worst nightmare, and it came true for you.
Yeah, it was a disaster. It was just, you know, 2010 was the WEG, and I'd started working for myself about that time and renting a big barn and, you know, slowly getting clients in, and people were sending your horses, and I really felt like everything was just starting to get going. And then there was an electrical fire in the middle of the night and burned this whole building. It was a massive building. Let's see, there's like 6 horses burnt to death, and then 4 or 5 others were in intensive care. And it was just a nightmare. And to have a horrible moment like that it sort of happened early in your career, it was a little bit of a tough thing to come your way. But it was, you know, there was, I don't know, I think I was raised in Australia where you just sort of get on with it, and you know, there was a lot of people saying, oh, how did you get through it? And you know, you just put your head down and keep waking up every day and keep chipping along. And America's a great country where had lots of people sort of help us out, and you know, before we knew it, we were sort of back in business. So in hindsight, it was a good test, but it was you know, it was a challenge and a test. And you know, part of I suppose your self-belief is, you know, that no matter what you get faced with here on out, if you can sort of get through a moment like that, anything else should be smooth sailing.
Should be possible. It didn't, I mean, I guess the months that followed were tough as well in their own right. I know you lost your father, your father-in-law as well, and the hit sort of kept on coming. But the light at the end of that sort of tunnel was, I guess, Burley, because Neville Bardot had been one of those horses that had been pulled from the fire by yourself and Philip, had been in intensive care, and then made the journey back to 5-star. That must have felt incredibly special after everything you've been through.
Yeah, it was great. I mean, Burley was an event that I'd always dreamed of competing at, and Neville was an absolute sort of Burley horse. Like, he was a hot, fiery thoroughbred from Australia that could gallop for days. And, you know, it was just a day-by-day process where, first of all, we were just trying to save his life and see if he could live out his days. And then, you know, the next step was, well, hang on, we can start riding him again. And then next thing, you know, he's jumping him and galloping him. And then he was already pretty fit before the fire. And, you know, it was just a day-by-day process to try and get the horse to the event. And to the horse's credit, man, he went fantastic around Burley that year. It was the tough, biggest course I'd ever ridden, and the horse was fantastic. And I think he finished like seventh or something like that. And great accomplishment. And again, just one of those moments where you're either, even though everything's going wrong, I can still achieve what I set out to do.
Yeah, absolutely. He did finish seventh. And I guess when you look at the fire being at the end of May and the heartbreak and the uncertainty to coming back at the beginning of September for a top 10 finish, you know, having travelled all the way over to England to do one of the biggest five stars, is just extraordinary. Can I ask you about your family life a little bit? Because your wife, Silver, we've already mentioned her. She competes internationally pure dressage as well. How has her impact been in terms of creating a career and a life and a yard and a family in the States for you?
Married well, to be quite frank. marrying a dressage rider, for any of you eventing guys out there listening, is a good career move. So, beyond that, she's obviously a great girl and great mum, and I don't think any normal woman would put up with my life, to be quite frank with you, Nicole, like in the sense of, you know, you're working 7 days a week, never have too much spare money because we're spending them all on horses. We never really go on vacation because we're away competing too much. You know, like what normal woman would sort of would put up with that? So picking a lady from the equestrian sports was sort of one of the keys. And Silver's obviously had a massive impact on my riding of being, you know, riding in the ring every day with Grand Prix horses and a lady that sort of has been trained by some of the best dressage trainers in Germany, and then having that influence your dressage riding, great. And then we bought this farm in Pennsylvania, and having our two kids grow up on the farm, I mean, it's a dream come true. It's a real ideal setup. Now she is very strict and very tough on me. And, you know, I just got to take that. She's a very clean person as well. Like, our house looks like a hospital. But so there's a couple of, you just got to sort of roll with the punches out there. But it's handy. The Australian event rider marrying the German dressage queen. So it's chalk and cheese.
She's got to keep you in line, Boyd.
She tries to.
It's been an extraordinary journey to this point, and I've absolutely no doubt there's going to be lots in store for both of you in the future. But I wanted to ask you a little bit about the number of horses and in terms of the horses that you compete, because actually you are one of the busiest riders in US eventing. In fact, I've got a fun fact for you. So in terms of riders that have had, I haven't told you this either, so it might be a surprise, who knows. Since 2014, there have been less than 30 times since a rider has had more than 100 runs in a season in terms of USEA runs. So this is national runs. And you appear inside the top 10, a grand total of 1, 2, 3, 4, I think, 5 times, and you hold the equal highest number of runs in a season as well, with 178. You're extraordinarily busy. And that kind of leads me on to the question that I wanted to ask you, because you had a real sort of peak in terms of horses that you were riding at international level, I guess around sort of 2016, 17, 18, when you had over 50 international runs each season. That dropped slightly in 2019 to 29. Has that been a conscious decision in terms of the number of horses that you're riding and competing at top level?
Yeah, it's a combination of a few things. I mean, when you're starting your business, you take on all comers. You know, if that phone rings and someone's got a horse down the street that bucks and rears and they want you to sort it out, you know, bring it over. And if the old lady down the road wants to see if you can take their fox hunter around a horse trial, you'll give that a crack. And so as time goes on, you sort of start streamlining those ones out of the way a bit. And to be honest, in 2019, I thought, you know, to get a bit better, I've got to start sort of doing less horses but better quality. And to be quite honest, about 2018 onwards, I started getting hurt a fair bit. Like my, you know, I've had a number of surgeries and my body's starting to give up a bit. So I realised that it's, you know, I remember when I was working for Philip, I rode 18 horses at one event on a Saturday, Sunday at a 3-day event. So I could never do that now. And, you know, so I think to get better is, I don't want to get remembered in America as the guy that rode the most horses. I got to try and get some of these top horses and try and start winning some of these big five stars. So it's a, you know, it's a change where, you know, quality over quantity is one thing. And secondly, I think the longevity of my career to try and keep going to my goal of competing at the five star level till I'm 70 is, you know, your body can't take the punishment and abuse that it once used to take. So it's sort of a few things all wrapped into one.
Well, I've got another fun fact for you, because that absolutely makes sense. You will be delighted to know that it is paying off, because in 2019 and 2020, you had two of your most successful seasons, even with fewer horses running, and two of your top three number of international victories came in those 2 years. And you broke your average dressage score into the 20s from all of your international runs last year for the very first time in your career. So that's quite cool. 29.2, which is pretty impressive.
Yeah, I think the judges got a bit easier, you know, with the COVID.
No.
All started to relax a bit. And I also had four surgeries last year. So the other reason I slowed down and got my wife to ride all the horses, and I just jumped off the show. So.
Silver was schooling them at home, or whatever it was, it absolutely worked. Talk to me a little bit about the surgeries and sort of coming back for 2021, because you did have a good deal of surgery last year, but a little bit of that was actually planned, wasn't it, in terms of good timing? Things were a bit quieter, so with COVID, actually to give yourself the chance to fully recover heading into what we hope will be Tokyo 2021.
Yeah, let's see, in 2019, I broke my pelvis and then tore my groin, and then that had to get repaired. And then I had hip surgery as soon as the plague came, and had some arthritis and bone spurs and labrum tears cleaned up. And then I got hurt again last year. And then I had one more sort of option surgery at the end of last year, a bit like a horse getting a bit of work done in the off season. So, just accept that, I don't mind it too much. There's a, you know, it's frustrating and depressing when you get hurt, because you sort of feel like the world's passing you by. But, you know, I think it's just part of the game where athletes riding horses at high speeds, at fixed obstacles, and sooner or later it goes wrong. And, you know, if you think about it, you know, last 20, 25 years, I've been just every day, you know, riding 10 or 15 horses and jump after jump and fall after fall. And I think I've just I'm sure I'm going to be crippled as hell when I'm older, and I'm quite fine with that idea, and I really just want to make the most of my riding career where I got the window here for the next 10 years or so, where I could really, really have a good crack at this.
What about that future then? So obviously you've been to Olympic Games, you've done World Equestrian Games, Pan American Games, gold medals. What next? What is the sort of items on your tick list that you would really like to check off?
Well, two things. I think being in America, I think we have the real chance, more so than the guys in England, to financially set ourselves up for the rest of our lives. You know, and I think the sport here is very, very lucrative, in the sense that there is money to be made out there, and there's I think being in America, I know it's way more competitive in England, and I know it's I'd probably be a better rider just because I'd be around better riders than me all the time. But here in America, I think we can really change the rest of our life, you know, of making sure that we can put some money away and invest in property and try and make the most of our career financially. And then part two of the question is, you know, like, I've done it all, in the sense of I've been a participant at the Olympics and a participant at the WEG, and yeah, I haven't actually won an individual medal, or I won a five-star years and years ago back in Australia, but I finished second, third, fourth at these big ones, you know, at Kentucky and Le Moulin, and you know, I've just missed out here and there. So I think that I'm close, but I haven't nailed it yet. And I look at riders like Timmy Price and Janelle and Birdo that they're still just a notch ahead of me, you know, as far as riders and competitors. And so I've still got a little bit of ground to make up and get a little bit better, chase some better horses, and really try and think that it would be good to try and go to these championships with the idea of I'm not just going to be a member of the team. I want to get in there and try and get up in the top placings or win it, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And one horse in your string now who has taken you very, very close to one of those big victories with a runner-up position at Kentucky back in 2019 is Setzeleg. The plan being for him very much, I imagine, is Tokyo this summer. And hopefully, dare I ask, we're recording this, listeners, at a time when the fundraising for Kentucky is happening. So we're not sure whether it will be going ahead or not. But I guess a five-star in the spring would have been the aim as well.
Yeah, don't want to get too Olympic focused, in the sense of, I remember when Neville Bardos in 2011 did really good, and then we sort of saved him and waited him and protected him, and then all of a sudden when you really need them, they're a bit rusty. So I think for me, I learned a lesson there that when the horses are fit and sound and in form is to try and pick out these marquee events, you know, these big Kentucky three-day events or Badmintons or Le Moulins, and try and win them, you know. And after that, if the horses come through it healthy and sound and there's a Olympics or a WEG around the corner, go for that. But to not sort of shape their whole career about having them ready for that one event. Because, you know, I've got a luxury. I've got four or five horses at that top level now. So if one gets injured or goes down, there's a replacement one there. But you just got to be a little bit careful about just trying to get selected or picked on the team, because you train them in a different way and you compete them in a different way, and you can miss out on some big results. To answer your question, I think Thomas, we call him, he's a great horse. Touch wood, he's been a really sound horse, and we'll just see what happens. Hopefully at Kentucky runs, and then maybe I'll take some of the other ones over to Badminton or something like that. So we'll just see how it all unfolds. It's a bit of a weird time, in the sense we're not quite sure what's around the corner.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you make a huge amount of sense, and it's something that I'm sure riders have different ways of looking at it, but it Sam certainly talked about it on this podcast before, of, you know, focus on what you can do right in front of you, because if you protect them too much, actually all of your eggs are in one basket and that basket may not come off. Will there be a chance that we could potentially see Thomas Setzeleg over in the UK at either Badminton or Burley in the future?
Yeah, I'd love to do that, both those ones on him. I think he'd be, if the Olympics doesn't happen, I'd try and get him to Burley. I think he could, he's one of those horses that's really good at every phase. He doesn't have a weak phase. He's a great galloper, good jumper, good on the flat, tough, resilient horse, doesn't matter the conditions. So it would be good to come to England and rendezvous with a few of the old sparring partners with Thomas, because I think he could actually shake, you know. So it's Yeah, we got that on our radar, and we'll just see how. I think we're in for a bit of a wonky year again here in 2021, but I think Thomas's career could go on for a bit further along. So I've got them lined up over there.
Big plans. Good, good. That's what we like to hear. And if we do get you over here for a badminton or a burly, and we've got Chris Burton and everybody else there, we might have to do a reunion podcast, because that would be a lot of fun.
A lot of great stories that no one knows about those guys. So
I was going to say, there would be all sorts you could tell us. If any of our listeners are sort of looking to keep following a horse in your yard over the next few years that you think is a future star, that either has been stepped up to international level or is a young horse, that who would you sort of say keep your eye on that one? Because I think a lot of them.
I've got a younger horse called Luke 140, and he's by Landos, which is the same sire of London 52, and he's just gone advanced now. He won the Galway 4-star long in California last November. He's about 15 hands high, and he's a rocket. He's really good on the flat. He jumps like a bunny rabbit. And again, I think he's probably got the horse that has got the most quality that I've ever had. And again, he's a bit of a wild man. He's sharp, and he's thrown me off a few times, but he's a real fighter. He's a great jumper, can do a very, very good dressage test. And I think that potentially could be a great horse coming through. But, you know, I got a bunch of up and coming horses, and I'm still very much enjoying the process and enjoying the bringing the horses along. You know, we were in this rinky dink competition down here in Aiken, and to me, I'm still loving it, and it's a great way to, and I can't even call it a job. You know, it's flying around the world with horses and competing and championship events. It's I've done well. I'm very, very grateful and proud of where I've ended up.
And I'm sure there is so much more still to come, but enjoy it. Boyd, thank you so much for coming on the show to talk to us. It has been really fascinating to go back and kind of relive some of the highlights of your career, and look forward to where we can see you next. But thank you very much for coming on the show.
Fantastic. Thank you for having me. It's a real privilege and honour talking to you and all the listeners out there. So thank you.
Thank you, Boyd. Listeners, we hope you've enjoyed this very, very special episode of the Equa Ratings Eventing Podcast. Do stay tuned, and we will be back with more very shortly. Thanks for listening. Thank you for listening to the Equa Ratings Eventing Podcast. This podcast is available for free on iTunes, Spotify, Podcast Addict, or wherever you usually listen to your podcasts. Make sure you subscribe so that you don't miss an episode. Find us at eventingpodcast.com or search Eventing Podcast on social media. We hope you enjoyed this bonus episode on the USEA official podcast, brought over from the Equa Ratings Eventing Podcast. If you would like to find out more, then head over and just search for Equa Ratings Eventing Podcast wherever you usually listen to your podcast. And don't forget, if you don't already, hit subscribe to both the USEA official podcast and, of course, the Equa Ratings Eventing Podcast. Thanks for listening.